The Lord woman is Elijah Day, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, at the 12th Hour in Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is February 3, 2017, or 8/7/2020. We will start our first service on this preparations day with the song and title, Just When I Need Him Most. Just when I need him, just when he's near, just when I falter, just when I fear, ready to help me, ready to cheer, just when I need him most, just when I need him most. Just when I need him more, just for his will to comfort and cheer, just when I need him more, just when I need him, just for his truth, never forsaking all the way through, giving for burden, pleasures are new, just when I need him more. Just when I need him more. Just when I need him more. Just for his little comfort and cheer. Just when I need him more. Just when I need him. Just for his strong, bearing the burdens all the day long, for all my sorrow, giving a song, just when I need him most, just when I need him most, just when I need him most. Just for his near to comfort and cheer, just when I need him most, just when I need him, he is my all, answering when upon him I call, tenderly watching lest I should fall, just when I need him. Just when I need him more, just when I need him more, just for his near to comfort and cheer, just when I need him more. Answer book number 4 by V.T. Hodder. We're going to continue with our study. We left off on page 7. With the article, when called themselves by the name of Yahweh, said, did not Abel call upon the name of Yahweh when he offered the sacrifice, Genesis 4:4? If so, then why does Genesis 4:26 say that after Seth is born, then began men to call themselves by the name of Yahweh? Although from the death of Abel to the birth of Seth, Genesis 4:25, Cain was the only living son of Adam. Yet neither he nor his posterity were followers of Yahweh, so they were the sons of man. But Seth and his descendants, who had the spirit of Abel, called on the name of Yahweh, and they were the sons of Yahweh, Genesis 6:2. Hence, as there were two different classes of worshipers, true and false, in close contact with each other, it became necessary to give themselves titles so as to make a distinction between the followers of the man and the followers of Yahweh. The descendants of Seth were the first to call themselves by the name of Yahweh, just as the Jews, who long afterwards accepted Yahshua, were the first to call themselves Christians, and just as the Jews, who rejected Yahshua, continued to call themselves Jews, so the descendants of Cain continue to call themselves the sons of men. From this scripture comes the evidence that the careless and ignorant religious practices which we see today with their persecuting spirit against those who worship Yahweh precisely as he has commanded, had their beginning with Cain. Also, that from Abel stems the influence of the obedience reaching even unto this day. Consequently, they are still in the world the sons of men as well as the sons of Yahweh. For the followers of the men and the followers of Yahweh, and just as the religion of the sons of men in those days was such as their father Cain had practiced, not according unto Elohim's command, but according unto their own choosing, so is the religion of the sons of men today. A great many still worship in the same manner in which their fathers did, not taking the slightest pains to know for themselves the difference between the false and the true, but naturally and thoughtlessly dashing along to their doom as a Gadarene swine dashed over the cliffs into the sea, Matthew 8:32, Mark 5:13. But despite the holy name which the sons of Seth took to themselves in those days, many of them intermingled with the sons of men, that is, the sons of Yahweh, saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose, Genesis 6:2. This evil practice speedily carried the wickedness of the sons of men into the homes of the sons of Yahweh. And Yahweh saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And he repented Yahweh that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved to him at his heart. And Yahweh said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. And behold, I do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life from under the heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. Genesis 6:5-7, 17. Looking forward unto our own day, Yahshua declared, for as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Matthew 24:38-39. Should not therefore the sons of Elohim in these days take all the more heed unto these examples and keep themselves separate from the daughters of men? These lessons teach that every individual himself, without the influence of another, should determine to know and to practice the truth if he wishes to escape the enemy's invisible webs spread along the path of his feet. He should now know the worst of his own case if he wants to keep his crown of life, of eternal life, his most precious treasure. If he does not, he will lose it. For the statement ends the symbolic code, July of 1935, Volume 1, number 13, page 9, that if the individual does not reform at the moment he is convinced of the truth, neither will he do it later. Makes me fearful. For if it is so, then I have done things to cause me to be lost. What hope is there for me? Answer. The code does not mean by the word reform that one must become perfect all at once. Perfection is attained through the continuing in the truth and climbing the ladder of the perfection step by step. See Testimony, Volume 1, page 187. A true Christian never lags behind, but as perfect corn of the field steadily develops in the ear, so also does he develop in the Christian sphere, as far as the light leads him forth. Hence, if you have made a start and are still running in the race, there is no reason why you should be lost. For a just man falls seven times and rises up again. Proverbs 24:16. And if any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Yeshua Messiah the righteous. 1 John 2:1. The class which does not reform according to the code are those who do not start in the race when convinced of advanced truth, but who, like the Jews of Yeshua's day or the later sins of the day, say, "We are rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing." Revelation 3:17. Or who, like Felix, excuse himself, saying, "Go thy way for this time, and I have a convenient season, I will call for thee." Acts 24:25. The fact that you are striving to overcome sin by walking in the light is sufficient evidence that you are not lost. And if you thus continue, you shall be saved. Else, we are all lost. The enemy would like to deceive us one way or another, he cares not which, and we should not give him any occasion. Paul's counsel is that, wherefore sin we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, says, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." Hebrews 12:1. Sanctify the moment or day by day. What part do we play in the process of sanctification, and when is a person sanctified? Answer. We should consider the words of the Apostle Paul in which he appeals unto his brethren, by the mercies of Yahweh, to present their bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto Yahweh. Sanctification is not merely a theory, an emotion, or a form of words, but a living, active principle entering into the everyday life. It requires that our habits of eating, drinking, and dressing be such as secure the preservation of the physical, mental, and moral health, that we may present to the Yahweh our bodies not an offering corrupted by wrong habits, but a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto Yahweh. Romans 12:1. Counsels on Health, page 67. True, sanctification comes through the working out of the principle of love. Yahweh is love, and he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in Yahweh, and Yahweh in him. The life of him in whose heart Yahshua abides will reveal practical righteousness. Their character will be purified, elevated, ennobled, and glorified. Pure doctrine will blend with the works of the righteousness. Heavenly precepts will mingle with the holy practices. Sanctification is not gained by a happy flight of feeling, but is the result of the constantly dying to sin and constantly living for the Messiah. Wrongs cannot be righted, nor reformations wrought in the character by the feeble intermittent efforts. It is only by the long, persevering effort, sore discipline, and stern conflict that we shall overcome. We know not one day how strong will be our conflict the next. So long as Satan reigns, we shall have self to subdue, besetting sins to overcome. So long as life shall last, there will be no stopping place, no point which we can reach and say, "I have fully attained." Sanctification is the result of lifelong obedience. Acts the Apostles, page 560. Day by day, hour by hour, a vigorous work of the self-denial and of sanctification must go on within. Then the works will bear witness that Yahshua is abiding in the heart by the faith, and I might add, faith in his blood. Sanctification does not close the avenues of the soul unto a knowledge, but expands the mind and inspires it to search for the truth as for a hidden treasure. Counsels to Teachers, page 449. There is no Bible sanctification for those who cast a part of the truth behind them. Testimonies, volume 1, page 338. For this work cannot go on in the heart while the light on any part of the truth is rejected or neglected. For the sanctified soul will not be content to remain in ignorance, but will desire to walk in the light and to seek for the greater light. As a miner digs for gold and silver, so the follower of Yahshua will seek for the truth as for hidden treasures, and will press from light to a greater light, ever increasing in knowledge. He will continue to grow in grace and in the knowledge of the truth. The Review and Herald, June 17, 1890. Many do not exemplify the truth in their life. They have special exercises upon the sanctification, yet cast the word of Yahweh behind them. They pray as sanctification, sing sanctification, and shout sanctification, for the present truth, which is in the channel, is not regarded, really is trampled underfoot. Men may cry, holiness, holiness, sanctification, sanctification, consecration, consecration, and yet know no more by experience of what they're talking than the sinner with his corrupt propensities. Yahweh will soon tear off this whitewashed garb or professed sanctification, which come who are carnally minded have thrown around them to the hide the deformity of the soul. Testimonies, Volume 5, page 338 and 336. Testimonies, Volume 1. Okay, the prophet Daniel was an example of the true sanctification. His long life was filled up with noble service for the Master. He was a man greatly beloved of heaven. Yet instead of claiming to be pure and holy, this honored prophet identified himself with the really sinful of Israel. As he pleaded before Elohim on behalf of his people, we do not present our supplication before thee for our righteousness, but for thy great mercies. We have sinned, we have done wickedly, he declares. I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people. And when at a later time the Son of Yahweh appeared to give him instruction, Daniel says, my comeliness was turned in me into corruption, and I retained no strength. When Job heard the voice of the Yahweh out of the whirlwind, he exclaimed, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. It was when Isaiah saw the glory of the Yahweh and heard the cherubim crying, holy, holy, holy is the Yahshua of the host, that he cried out, woe is me, for I am undone. Paul, after he was caught up into the third heaven and heard things which is was not possible for a man to utter, speaks of himself as less than the least of all saints. The Great Controversy, 4:70-71. Paul's sanctification was a result of a constant conflict with self. He said, I die daily. His will and his desire every day conflicted with the duty and the will of Yahweh. Instead of following inclination, he did Elohim's will. However, crucifying his own nature, Yahweh leads his people on step by step. The Christian life is a battle and a march. In this warfare, there is no release. The effort must be continuous and persevering. It is by unceasing endeavor that we maintain the victory over the temptations of Satan. Christian integrity must be sought with resistless energy and maintained with a resolute fixedness of purpose. No one will be born upward without stern, persevering effort in his own behalf. All must engage in this warfare for themselves. The struggle for conquest over self for holiness and heaven is a life-long struggle. Without continual effort and constant activity, there can be no advancement in the divine life, no attainment of the victor's crown. Testimonies, Volume 8, page 313. This is the will of Yahweh concerning human beings, even their sanctification. In the urging our way upward, heavenward, every faculty must be kept in the most healthful condition, prepared to do faithful service. The powers with which Elohim has endowed man are to be put to the stretch. Man cannot possibly do this of himself. He must have divine aid. What part is the human agent to act? Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is always which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Philippians 2:12-13. Finally, the working of the principle of the true sanctification in the Christian heart is intimate, admittedly illustrating Yahshua's parable of the growing seed. First the blade, then the ear, after that the full corn and the ear. Mark 4:28. Thus from grace to grace ascends the climb of the true sanctification, which is the dynamic process of the progressive regeneration through the continual impartation of the righteousness of Yahshua by the power of the indwelling spirit of the Yahweh. The Great Controversy 469. For the impartation of the Spirit is the impartation of the life of Yahshua. Gospel Workers, page 285. Complete sanctification. By way of the comparison, the righteousness by which we are justified, the first phase of the sanctification, is imputed. The righteousness by which we are sanctified, the second phase, is imparted. The first is our title to heaven. The second is our fitness for heaven. The Review and Herald, June 4, 1895. In the Book of the Christ, Our Righteousness, page 98. The generation of the seed represents the beginning of the spiritual life, and the development of the plant is a beautiful figure of the Christian growth. As in the nature, so in the grace. There can be no life without the growth. The plant must either grow or die. As its growth is silent and imperceptible, but continuous, so is the development of the Christian life. At every stage of development, our life may be perfect. Yet, if Elohim's purpose for us is fulfilled, there will be continual advancement. Sanctification is the work of a lifetime. As our opportunities multiply, our experience will enlarge, and our knowledge increase. We shall become strong to bear responsibility, and our maturity will be in proportion to our privileges. Yahshua's Object Lessons, page 65 and 66, by Ellen White. Here is the Bible sanctification. It is not merely the show or outside work. It is sanctification received through the channel of the truth. It is a truth received in the heart and practiced and practically carried out in the life. Testimonies, volume 1, page 339. Yahshua prayed for his disciples in these words, "Sanctify them to thy truth. Thy word is truth." There is no genuine sanctification except through the obedience unto the truth. The Sanctified Life, page 49. Please explain the following statement from the Shepherd Route, volume 1, page 153. Now to his people he gives 1 year to make good. It's called spewed out or cast out. The foregoing statement simply means that Elohim limited the leaders of the Laodicea to 1 year in which to accept the sealing message and to carry it to their respective churches. Upon their failing to do so, by the end of this limited period of grace, he rejected them as his servants And now, if any of them accepts the additional message, testimony, ministry, page 106, Gospel Workers, 304, and desire to carry it to the lady, they may do so only under the direction of the present message. The reorganization spoken of in Yahshua's Christ Our Righteousness, 1941 edition, page 121. What is the rod of my son? Will you please explain the meaning of the rod as used in Ezekiel 21:8-15? He calls Israel the rod of his son, Psalms 74:2, and Psalms 110 verse 2. Yahweh shows that they were his rod for punishing the heathen, just as Assyria was his rod for punishing Israel, Isaiah 10:5. This rod is an emblem of the power or government, also an instrument of punishment. What is the sword of the Yahweh? Does the Bible mean knives, guns, or bayonets when it means it speaks of sword of the Yahweh in the latter day? Answer. The term sword is used in the scriptures, signifies war, bloodshed, and vengeance. Elohim's sword is whatever instrument he uses to execute judgment. It is not necessarily a steel blade. Often it has been a pestilence, fire, famine, earthquake, war, and a host of other elemental forces. Even the wicked, as witnessed, says David's cry, deliver my soul from the wicked, which is a sword. Psalm 17:13. Are Zion and Jerusalem the same? Question number 85. Please explain the difference between terms Zion and Jerusalem in Isaiah 52:1, Revelation 14:1. Zion, the Jerusalem of Israel, Isaiah 52:1, must represent people. For it would be ridiculous to say to a hill and to a city, awake, awake, put on thy strength, put on thy beautiful garments. On the ancient Zion's exalted hill stood the palace of the king, and the rulers of the people dwelt at Jerusalem. The rest of the people also cast lots to bring one of the ten to dwell in Jerusalem, the holy city, and nine parts to dwell in other cities. Nehemiah 11:1. So the royal family resided on Mount Zion, and the lesser rulers and other government representatives dwelt in Jerusalem proper. The call, awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, is applicable unto the Laodicean church, the last of the seven churches, and the one which terminates the period of the wheat and the tares, commingled, because after she puts on her beautiful garment, the unclean shall no more come into her. Those who will awake to the rousing call, put on strength by the separating from the wicked, and put on the beautiful garments by the turning unto righteousness, are those who will in the latter days make up Zion and Jerusalem, the princes and rulers of the people, and the kingdom congregation restored. This is what we're after, the kingdom congregation restored. Kingdom of heaven. And then clad in the armor of Yahshua's righteousness, the church is to enter upon her final conflict. Fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army of banners. She is to go forth into all the world, conquering and to conquer. Prophecy 7:25. Hence only those who have withstood temptation and the strength of the Mighty One will be permitted to act a part in the proclaiming of the third angel's message when it shall swell into the loud crowd. Review and Herald, November 19, 1908. Now as to the meaning of the two terms Zion and Jerusalem as used in Revelation 14:1. The second reference in question, the Revelator explains that 144,000 of the 12 tribes of Israel are those who make up Zion. His words are, and I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written in their foreheads. Revelation 14:1. These being the first fruits, Revelation 14:4, as further shows that they are the first of the harvest, and the end of the world, Matthew 13:39. Obviously then those who were seen after them, a great multitude of all nations, Revelation 7:9, are none other than the second fruits of the harvest, some of whom will dwell in Jerusalem. So at this harvest time it will come to pass that the mountain of Yahweh's house, Mount Zion, shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. Isaiah 2:2. Has he or will he tread them down? Question number 86. Through Isaiah 63:3, Yahshua declared of himself, I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garment, and I will stain all my raiment. Does this scripture apply to Yahshua's work at the time of his first or at the time of his second advent? Answer. The first part of the verse applies to the first advent of Yahshua, and the last part to the time of the purification of the church, and that would be at his second advent. Thus, and that would be still in the future. Thus, Yahshua is, by use of the prophetic language, appears to be looking back on the time of his suffering while he was on the cross, emphasizing that there were none with him, and that therefore, by inference, those who had no part in his agony have no right to rule over those whom he set free, and that who continues to hold his people in bondage and in ignorance of his truth. Will he tread in his anger and trample them in his fury and sprinkle their blood upon his garments, thereby staining all his raiment and thus setting his people free? Baptized for remission of sins or for progressing with the truth? As we were admitted into the Seventh-day Adventist Church membership on our former baptism in the Baptist Church, is it now necessary for us to be rebaptized? Answer. The Holy Scriptures teach a need of one baptism only, Ephesians 4:5, as you were baptized by immersion in the Baptist Church and later united with the Seventh-day Adventist Church for no reason other than to walk in the brighter light of the Word. You had no need for rebaptism, as if you have been true to your Christian vow. Also, in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, then you have no need for the rebaptism. Suppose you had been baptized by the Apostle Paul and received into the church fellowship, lived on up to the present time, all the while walking in the advancing light of the Yahweh. You would have followed him through all of the seven successive movements of the Reformation, the seven church periods. In the Protestant period, you would have been Lutheran first and Davidian last. And you're thus having faithfully followed the light of the truth. It is neither scriptural nor logical that Elohim would have required you to be rebaptized every time you took a step forward. Who is the king of the Mount Carmel Center, Yahweh or man? Most of us have had a struggle to loose ourselves from the band laid upon us by the church's present leadership, and it seems no more than right that we have the assurance that the Yahweh is directing in all the movements of the Mount Zion. May we know just how much of the work of Mount Carmel is under the direction of the Yahweh's answer. A careful thinking through of this matter can end only in the realization that as Elohim has promised to take the reins in his own hands, then that is exactly what he of necessity must be doing. Hence, all the confusion and perplexity with questioning, criticizing, and doubting over the work are irrational, inexcusable, and damaging. Satan says the spirit of prophecy has the ability to suggest doubts and to devise objections to the pointed testimony that Elohim sent, and many think it a virtue, a mark of the intelligence in them, to be unbelieving and to question and quibble. Those who desire to doubt will have plenty of room. Elohim does not propose to remove all occasion for unbelief. He gives evidence which must be carefully investigated with a humble mind and a teachable spirit. And all should decide from the weight of the evidence, testimony, volume 3, page 255. Moreover, no man can judge the work by his own wisdom or by the wisdom of other human beings. For says the spirit of the truth, the workers will be surprised by the simple means that he will use to bring about and perfect his work of righteousness. Let me tell you that the Yahweh will work in this last work in a manner very much out of the common order of things and in a way that will be contrary unto any human planet. Testimony Message, page 300. It is not for you to be intimidated by the outward appearances, however, forbidden. They may be. It is for you to carry forward the work as the Yahweh has said it should be carried. Testimony Volume 9, page 141. If each does well his part in the work that is given him to do, he will soon see that he has neither need nor capability to look after the Yahweh's duties or after the work that is assigned unto others. He will know that the greatest and the only right thing he can do is courageously to accept the high challenge of the angel of Yahweh unto Joshua, if thou wilt walk in my ways, if thou wilt keep my charge, and then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my course, and I will give thee places to walk among these that stand by. Zechariah 3:7. For the present truth believers, one of the surest evidences that the Yahweh is leading in the work of the Mount Carmel is that regardless of the ceaseless opposition, paucity of laborers, and many other handicaps, the work is steadily moving onward with an irresistible power. It is indeed like the mustard seed. Despite its humble and insignificant beginning, the criticism and the opposition against it and the multiform obstacles and impediments which it has had to surmount, it is awakening multitudes throughout Laodicea. It has launched a ship of reformation, and while many already boarded it, others are rapidly approaching the decision to seek the safeties it affords. They are restating the Bible in the divine light of the shepherd's rod. The three angels' messages have become to them as clear and sweet as a mountain stream. And those who never owned, or even those who never believed, the writings of the spirit of prophecy are now purchasing all the volumes. Certainly no one can thoughtfully say that such is the work of the enemy, not without attributing authorship of the Bible unto Satan. If the Bible is of the Yahweh, the message is the rod, and the rod cannot be of the devil, for it is the Bible unfolded. Never without the power of Elohim could it have so leavened the whole denomination. For the all-powerful one declares, I the Yahweh do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would sit the briars and thorns against me in the battle? I would go through them. I would burn them together. Isaiah 27:3-4. Those who only profess to believe are here warned that the Yahweh knows their work and that he has not left his workers in the darkness concerning it. Exposing their secrecy says, also, thou son of man, for the children of thy people still are talking against thee by the walls and in the doors of the houses, and speak one to another, every one to his brother, saying, Come, I pray ye, and hear what is the word that cometh forth from the Yahweh. And they come unto thee as the people cometh, and they sit before thee as my people, and they hear thy words, and they will not do them, for with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goeth after covetousness. And lo, thou art unto them as a very lovely song of one that hath a pleasant voice, and can play well on an instrument, for they hear thy words, but they do them not. And when this cometh to pass, lo, it will come, then shall they know that that a prophet hath been among them. Ezekiel 33:30-33. Is it too late to get into the net? Here is among us one who is teaching that if the net was drawn ashore, Matthew 13:47-48, in 1930, then those who were not in it at that time, that is, who were not then members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, cannot hope to be a part of the first fruit. If true, then why should one attempt to come in now rather than to wait for the time of the second fruit? Or if already in the message, they should, why should he continue striving to live up to it if his efforts are bound in futility because he missed the deadline? Answer. For the parabolical act of drawing the net to the shore, the Yahshua is momentarily intermitting his work, does not in the literal sense or the literal connection bar any from getting into it if they put forth the necessary effort. For though fish as fish cannot actually swim to a net after it is drawn ashore, yet as people they can actually get into the church up until the close of probation. Other thing is, when that net is drawn ashore and the fish didn't get in it while it was in the water, then probation closes for them. See, this is what V.T. Hallett didn't understand when he wrote this. Surely, if a good fish managed to get into the net while it is being hauled ashore, the fishermen will not throw them out with the bad, simply because the net did not catch them. Rather, they will be accounted even more precious because of their own extra effort expended in getting in. Without anyone going after them with the net, if one cannot see the possibility of himself as a fish getting into the net, he can easily see himself as a sheep getting into the fold. Clearly then, the dead line idea is a specious concept, which can only discourage the Christian progress, causing some already in the message to rationalize their way out because of the futility of the staying in, and justifying others in not making the necessary effort to get into the net of the salvation when the opportunity presents itself. Indeed, it even forces them to forego their present opportunity and to wait for one that is never coming. Today, says the Spirit of Yahweh, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. Hebrews 4:7. What to do when disfellowship? Should those of us who have been disfellowshipped continue to attend church services? If so, and if the opportunity there presents itself for us to speak a word incident to present truth, should we? But what if we are asked to say nothing suggestive of present truth? Should we acquiesce and remain silent forever? And what shall we do if they do not let us participate in the communion service? Answer. For my answer, if they'd ask me that now, I'd say, well, go to the kingdom where they keep the communion service once a year by the law of Moses, which is supposed to apply today. Then they don't have to worry about going to Adventist and keeping it every 13th week. Because that's abomination. There's no law for that in the law and the law of Yahweh, in the book of the law of Yahweh, period. Okay, our answer says our relationship to the Seventh-day Adventist Church is the same as with John the Baptist, Yeshua the Messiah, and the apostles. We have a message to proclaim to the church, and though the church officials order us out as the Sanhedrin or the apostles out of the temple, we must, in a righteous way, refused to leave and must continue returning to the temple. For if we depart and stay away and become strangers, how then shall we proclaim the message to our people? All must realize, however, that it ill becomes a Christian to cause any disturbance at any time, especially during church services. Neither is it possible for any of us by such methods to present the message to them or to convince them that we are speaking the words of their life by witnessing silently, reverently, and circumspectly in the congregation and out of the congregation we shall give provocation for naught but false accusation. And Sabbath school is perfectly right and permissible to answer questions which arise in connection with the lesson. For this, they cannot justly accuse anyone of causing disturbance, as it is in no wise an infraction of the constituted purpose and rules of the Sabbath school. But if anyone should be specifically requested not to answer a question, then let him refrain from doing so, rather than cause contention and displeasure. It is wrong to create controversy or to argue over any points which may arise. Nothing but harm to the cause of the present truth can result from such procedure. Let your deportment win the people's confidence. Two of the chief reasons for not staying away from the Sabbath school and church services are: number one, that we would be depriving ourselves of the privilege of public worship in the congregation or in the temple that we help build. Number two, that by absenting ourselves from the services, we would become strangers to our brethren and would have to become reacquainted with them if ever we were to give the message unto them. By continuing, though, to go to the congregation and serve the evidence, we are then, after the congregation is dismissed, afforded an opportunity to speak with the brethren in the interest of the message, urging them to investigate for themselves, either by the attending our studies or by the reading the publications of the present truth. Also, there is always an opportunity to get one or more new names and addresses to send in for our mailing list. So if we voluntarily stay away from the congregation services, we lay ourselves open unto the charge of being offshoots from the body, and at the same time forfeit the opportunity of coming in contact with the congregation. Moreover, if in this wise we separate ourselves, then in the fulfillment of Ezekiel 9, when those who have not the mark are taken away, we shall not have the same right to claim an inheritance in the denomination. In regard to our participating in the denomination's communion service, we believe that inasmuch as it regularly celebrates this ordinance, we should take part in it in so far as is possible. For should we voluntarily absent ourselves from it, we should then give them a wrong impression. If the church refuses the service or to let us serve others in the ordinance of the humility, there is nothing we can do but wait until the service is over. And if they ignore us when passing the bread and the wine, we are not to murmur or say anything, but to endure patiently the slight by so demeaning ourselves. The honest ones in the congregation will see the unchristlike attitude and the folly of the church officers and will begin to arouse and take in the situation. Though we may, against our will, be excluded from the participating in the ordinances, we nevertheless shall have our names in the book of the life, and like the unbaptized thief on the cross, shall enter paradise for having done our very best. Therefore, brethren, let us be faithful in our attending church services and our deportment, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. Hebrews 4:1. What is the difference between come and coming? In the Shepherd Rod, Volume 1, page 20, the point is made that John saw the angel of Revelation 18 not coming, not in flight on his way down, but come down, that is, already arrived. But in plain English, come down means descend. And Sister White says, as he descended, however, therefore can the rod rightly lay stress upon the thought that John saw him already come, already arrived, when something of the high velocity, such as a bullet or a bolt of lightning, is coming on, its high rate of travel does not give an observer time to view the continuity of its onward progress, its coming. He is able to behold it only when it is finally arrived, come. Thus the fact that the angel of Revelation 18:1 is seen not coming, as the angel of Revelation 7:2, but come, signifies that he comes suddenly, like the angel of Daniel 9:21. By contrast, in beholding the approach of an object such as the sun, an observer is well able to keep steadily in view the continuity of its ascending. Accordingly, the rod observes that the angel of Revelation 7:2 was seen while yet afar off, ascending from the east, because he was coming slowly, like the sun, whereas the angel of Revelation 18:1 was seen suddenly come, because the terrific momentum of his downward flight did not allow enough time for the human eye to see him coming. This distinction between the speed of the two angels, because of the different significance of each, is the point of the stress. If half and half, then what about now? The Shepherd Rod, Volume 1, page 30, makes the statement that the Seventh-day Adventist denomination numbered about 300,000 at the time the book was written. This fact, suggesting that about half the 144,000 are the five wise virgins, and that the other half are the five foolish virgins. But how can this be so when today the denomination numbers 500,000? Answer. Writing in 1930, the Rod was necessarily speaking in terms not of then unknown membership of today, but of the established membership of that time. At that time, and though the number then 300,000 did naturally suggest about an even division of members, two classes, good and bad, wise virgins and foolish virgins, yet as there are only 144,000 Israelites to be sealed, the number of the unsealed would have been then exceeded the number of the sealed. In the final analysis, however, it is not of the rod's purpose nor its intent to say just how many wise and how many foolish there will be in the first fruits harvest. For when the whole truth is made known, the figure of the five wise virgins, besides comprehending the 144,000 from the tribes of Israel, may be found to include a considerable number from the Gentile nations. Does membership supersede knowledge or truth? Although I am not a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, yet since I have the light on Ezekiel 9 and on the truth of the 144,000, will I fall in the slaughter of the wicked if I do not fully accept and live up to the light? And conversely, will I be subject to the enjoyment of the privileges of the 144,000 and be one of them if I obey all the light of this message? Answer, even though you are not a member of the church, still you will be held accountable for the light which you have on the subject, for no one finds the truth accidentally or sees it without the Holy Spirit's aid. By the same law of the accountability or sacred responsibility, even though you may have come into the message only recently, you can be eligible for the election of the 144,000 if you live up to the message that is to purify and seal them. Whether or not for a certainty, however, you will be one of them, we do not know, but if you are faithful to the message, you will at least be one with them. I now believe that I am entitled to membership, but am I entitled to membership? Now, if one has read the Shepherd Rod series and has learned and believes what the message teaches, would you advise him first to join the Seventh-day Adventist denomination? Answer. If one has unreservedly accepted the whole truth, his privilege and duty is to be baptized into the congregation's fellowship, but having studied the third angel's message through the medium of the rod, which is opposed by the Seventh-day Adventist ministry, he may consequently be denied baptism and membership by them. Nevertheless, if he has done all he can to receive baptism and to unite with the congregation, and they refuse to fellowship him, then his duty is to arrange with the Mount Carmel Centers for baptism and membership. It is having of the one's name in the books, not merely of the church, but of heaven. That is the guilt-edged security of salvation. That is the guilt-edged. And it is the acceptance of the message of the hour and the commensurate endeavor faithfully to obey all his teaching, that when the saints fellowshiped in heaven's sonship certificate, as one witness for present truth, its enemies in the denomination will oppose and disfellowship him if he already holds membership there, but such deprivation must not discourage him. Blessed are ye, says Yahweh, when men shall hate you, and when they shall separate you from their company, and shall reproach you, and cast out your name as evil, for the Son of Man's sake. Luke 6:22. I hear the word of Yahweh, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, said, let the Yahweh be glorified, but he shall appear unto your joy, and they shall be ashamed. Isaiah 66:5. Well, this brings the close of our study this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour. Call us number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close this service now with a song.
King of my life, I crown thee now. Thine shall the glory be. Lest I forget thy thorn-crowned brow. Lead me to Calvary, lest I forget Gethsemane, lest I forget thine agony, lest I forget God's love for thee. Lead me to Calvary. Show me the tomb where thou wast laid, tenderly hard and red. Angels in robes of light arrayed, guarded thee while thou slept. Lest I forget Gethsemane, lest I forget thine agony, lest I forget thy love for me. Lead me to Calvary. Let me, like Mary, through the gloom, come with a gift to thee. Show to me now the empty tomb. Lead me to Calvary. Lest I forget Gethsemane. Lest I forget thine agony. Lest I forget thy love for me. Lead me to Calvary. May I be well in your treatment, daily my cross for thee. Even thy cup of grief to share, thou hast borne all for me. Lest I forget Gethsemane, lest I forget thine agony, lest I forget thy love for me. Lead me to Calvary.